Done yet? Okay. Let me work on it. Something went out. Testing.
Did it go out on everybody?
It must have, because I got a little notice came up. Testing. How's that? Is it okay now? Oh, okay, good. Parthaya Pratibodhitam Bhagavata Narayanena Swayam Vyasena Gratitam Purana Munina Madhye Mahabharatam Advaitamrita Varshinim Bhagavatim Ashtadashadhyayinim Ambatvam Anusantatami Bhagavad Gita Bhavadveshini.
Did you get the Swamiji's Gita yet? Mm-hmm. I should make you a copy of this. This is Gita Dhyanam. we chant the first verse of it. Gita Dhyanam. I can make a copy of this.
Thank you.
You too.
Maybe the home study course will
even
have this book.
Yeah, the only reason you really need that book is for this.
Oh,
okay. And I can give you this. Because I think the Gita Home Study uses the same translation, but it gives a word for word and everything else. So it's nice to have that book just because it's small. And, you know, just for this. Now we're moving into chapter 16. Chapter 16 is really interesting. It's some, how many verses? It's about 24 verses or something. Let me see. 24 verses, mm-hmm. Right? It's 24 verses. It's the whole thing has to do with Antakarana Shuddhi and the values. The first three verses are the positive values. They're called the Daivi Sampat. Daivi means it's like the Antakarana that the devas would have. You know, the wealth, it's like the divine wealth, you know, or the sattvika buddhi, that mind which is pure and free and clear, free of raga dvesha, just like a clean mirror. And so it's called the daivi sampat. Sampat means wealth. So the wealth of born of the devas, or born of just tejas or luminosity, without any of the ajnanam born problems, really, values that cause, and the values that are really born of ignorance, that cause a lot of stress, and wrong values cause a lot of pain, adharma, cause a lot of pain in the mind. And so the first thing he does is, with three verses, he goes just through these major positive values that are actually natural to a mind that's not riddled with raga dvesha, with likes and dislikes. When your mind, those times when your mind is free of likes and dislikes, of raga dvesha, this is who you naturally are. This is how the mind naturally behaves with love and compassion and care for others and all of that. That's natural to you. What gets in the way is when you have a desire, you know, and people or situations get in the way of that desire, then all kinds of negativity is generated around these unfulfilled or thwarted desires. And that causes the dvesha, actually. Dvesha, or that hatred or dislike, is really just a reaction to a thwarted desire. Something is not going the way you want it to go, for whatever reasons, and who's ever involved in that, thwarting your fulfillment of that desire, gets cast upon them some negative negative reactions. So this raga, that all of the desires that we really have, or all of the negative feelings that we already that we have, are just really a reaction to our own pain. And often our own pain is caused by not being able to fulfill the things that we believe we need to be whole and complete. It's so simple, really. If we believe we need this certain thing to be whole and complete and to have a happy, meaningful life, if that is taken away from us, there's a whole slew of feelings that we have, from resentment to hatred to rage to you name it. We can fit it in. Of the negative spectrum, right? Depends on the situation, what negative part of the negative spectrum that would be evoked. So there's a whole process of neutralizing one's raga dvesha, one's likes and dislikes. It's called that karma yoga buddhi. There's a whole way of relating to the world where there's a neutralization of the likes and dislikes themselves. With knowledge, of course, they get neutralized. But until one has knowledge, you also need to have a relationship with the world, with Dharma itself, that neutralizes the force of the raga dvesha. So more and more, what becomes more important to you as a person is to do Dharma. If something, some pleasurable activity you would like to do, as long as it's supported by Dharma, there's no problem with it at all. But Dharma has to come first. And there comes a time where your commitment is to Dharma, not to pleasure, not to sensory pleasure. There's nothing wrong with sensory pleasure, but that's not your commitment. The commitment is to Dharma. Dharma comes first. And when Dharma comes first, in fact, we say that whole Ishvara Arpana Buddhi. Ishvara Arpana Buddhi means where your mind, the commitment, is really to the worship of Bhagavan, worship of the Lord. And what that means, I mean, how do you operationalize that? What does it mean to have a commitment to the worship of the Lord is really a commitment to Dharma, to just the laws of the creation, to honoring the laws of the creation. And so what are those laws in terms of Dharma and Adharma, in terms of the experience of Shanti? What means of behavior, what is the Dharma that allows for the mind to naturally have shanti? Shanti means it has peace. The mind enjoys peace. And a peaceful mind enjoys naturally a sense of well-being, even if it's relative, because the peace may be relative. But when there's peace there, there's a natural state of well-being, because the nature of the self, of the Atma, is one of well-being. Who you are, your very swarupa, your very nature, is one of love or wholeness or completeness. That's the nature of conscious being itself. And so when your mind is not disturbed or upset or angry or hurt and agitated in one way or another, it becomes clean, like a mirror, like a clean mirror, a clean glass that's not competing with the emotions and feelings, and the rage because of the stress and the tension is creating emotions that in a way are competing with the ananda, the wholeness of yourself. The wholeness of your own being, the beauty of your own being is still self-evident for one who's differentiated it, and is still very present to whatever is going on in the mind. But when something very painful is going on in the mind, the whole system tries to come to its rescue. All of your defenses try to come to the rescue of that painful mind. And the defenses are going to be just the real psychological defenses that we learn about in therapy, you know, dissociation, etc., all kinds of defenses. But also the defenses that we've worked out in our ignorance in the world, you know, like how to cope with this situation. A lot of times it's striking out through anger, you know, it's rage or fury or just knocking somebody out of my life. Or it's just so many things, ways that we cope. And your coping skills can become more sophisticated, you know. But they can still be coping skills that are born of ignorance, and the coping skills born of knowledge are a lot better. They work a lot better. They work a lot better because coping skills born of knowledge resolve the whole problem, resolve whatever problem you're facing into the source of the Ananda itself. The problem is that you're projecting Ananda onto the world and then running after it, you know, running after the illusion of it, and then trying to hang on to it. It's like trying to hang on to an illusion, an illusory power that's been projected, that something has been bathed in. Something in the world that is just actually absolutely neutral has been bathed in this illusory power of Ananda. The illusory power, the illusory, actually, it's been bathed in the projection of your being, of your very being, of the wholeness of your very being has been projected onto something in the creation, and then, of course, you need it. You need to get yourself back. And it's a desperate thing. To whatever, however strong the desire is for that thing, the more desperate you are, because it's the desire for love and the desire for wholeness. It's the desire for myself. That's what it is. And that desire for myself has been projected onto someone or something. And then when somehow that is thwarted, there can be tremendous rage. You can kill for it. People kill for that. The rage that comes when you feel that your wholeness has been robbed from you or taken away. It's an amazing thing. You know, knowledge is ultimately the total solution for that. So, anyway, what's being talked about here really are these two sets of qualities. One is called the Daivi Sampat, that wealth, that divine wealth, that spiritual wealth in the form of values. And the other one is called the Asura Sampat. And that is the kind of dark side. The asuras are those who are, for them, for the that asuric mentality. It's not that we're all not asuras sometimes. Sometimes we have predominantly that Daivi Sampad, that wealth, that kind of that spiritual wealth is what is really up for us. And other times that asuric sampad, that wealth of that asuric wealth, where for that, that means at those times what is most important to me are my raga dvesha's, the fulfilling of my likes and dislikes. That's what matters. It's all about me, and it's all about getting, fulfilling my desires. And that's it. And then that creates a lot of negativity. So in this chapter, what he says is, since prior to this, we've gone through so many of the positive, qualities, like so in chapter 9 and chapter 13, we've gone through 20 of them. So in chapter 12, the whole end part of chapter 12 is just going over all of the beautiful values, you know, that one who has antikarma shuddhi has. This time we're going to touch on those lightly, you know, 3 verses, and the rest of them we're going to look at all of the horrible ones. because really, when we look at the negative ones also, that gives a certain discernment, you know. And so you know what to, it just brings it to consciousness. That kind of those negative things that cause yourself pain and everybody else pain also. To really, what he does is he just really spends time on each one of those, so that you can get a feel for it and know what to avoid, or when that's taking place in you, how to deal with that. Mm-hmm. What antidote can you bring in when these negative ones are taking place? You know, it's good to know the positive ones, but when the negative ones, then you have something to work on. Whenever a negative one shows up, then that becomes your sadhana. Right? That's the thing that you're working on then. You shouldn't worry about it. It just, you know what it is, and then you know how to work with it. Because you don't have a value for it. And if you have a value for it, then you probably wouldn't be in this class. You know? Because you want something else in your life. You know, something that has to do with just power and fulfillment of raga dveshas, your likes and dislikes, and just, that's it. This wouldn't be very interesting. So, let's do the first verse. Okay. And Swamiji, actually, for all of them, The first three, he spends quite a bit of time, especially in the first one or two. So we're going to chant actually all three, because as you'll see, it's really at the end of the third verse that the verb comes. Right? So, even though we might only finish one or two of these. Let's see. So, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha, Abhayam Sattva Shuddhi, Abhayam Sattva Sam Shuddhi. Say it again. Abhayam Sattva Sam Shuddhi, Jnana Yoga Vyavastitaha Stitihi, Jnana Yoga Vyavastitihi, Dhanam Dhammascha Yajnascha, Dhanam Dhammascha. To do it again. Sorry. We're going to have to do this whole thing over, but that's okay. We'll just get through this line and then do it again. Dhanam Dhammascha Yajnascha, Dhanam Dhammascha Yajnascha, Swadhyayastapa Arjavam, Swadhyayastapa Arjavam, Abhayam Sattvasam Shuddhihi, Abhayam Sattvasam Shuddhihi, Jnana Yoga Vyavastitihi, Jnana Yoga Vyavastitihi, Dhanam Dhammascha Yajnascha, Dhanam Dhammascha Yajnascha, Swadhyayastapa Arjavam, Swadhyayastapa Arjavam, Arjavam, Ahimsa Satyam Akrodaha, Ahimsa Satyam Akrodaha, Tyaga Shantir Paishinam, Tyaga Shantir Paishinam, Deya Bhuteshu Lo Luptvam, Deya Bhuteshu Lo Luptvam, Mardavam Hri Rachapalam, Mardavam Hri Rachapalam, Tejakshamatritishaucham, Tejakshamatritishaucham, Adroho nati manita, Adroho nati manita, Bhavanti sampadam daivim, Bhavanti sampadam daivim, Abhijatasya bharata, Abhijatasya bharata. So he says, Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. I'm going to read this verse by verse, breaking the Sandhi. Abhayam, Abhayam, Sattva Samshuddhihi. Okay. Abhayam, Sattva Samshuddhihi. Jnana Yoga Vyavastitihi. Dhanam Dhammaha Cha Yajnaha Cha Swadhyayaha Tapaha Arjavam. Ahimsa Satyam Akrodaha Tyagaha Shantihi Apaishinam. Daya Bhuteshu Aloluptvam Mardavam Urihi Achapalam. Tejaha Kshama Dhritihi Shaucham Adrohaha Natimanita. Bhavanti Sampadam Daivim Abhijatasya Bharata. So in the very last sentence of verse 3, he says, Just a minute. Well, what this says is a strange use of the genitive. Sometimes with the genitive, we have the use of the word have or has. In Sanskrit, there is no verb to have. Mm. So you use the genitive plus some nominatives. And so what this, you have a whole list of qualities that we're going to be going through one by one. Okay. And so the one, that one who has all of these qualities, you know, that person has this Daivi, this spiritual wealth. So when we say sampadam daivim, right? The sampadam daivim, the spiritual wealth, is there. But the one who has this spiritual wealth is the one who has all of these qualities. All of these qualities make up that spiritual wealth. And for who? For the one who has these qualities, for that person, there is this spiritual wealth. That's what's said here. Okay. So we'll go through it one by one, then you'll understand it.
Spiritual wealth?
Well, what are you going to say? Spiritual diving, the wealth, that wealth, as I was explaining earlier, Deva, the Devatas, like the gods and goddesses and all of the higher lokas, that word Deva comes from the root div. The word div is to shine, luminosity. So the devas, their antakaranas all shine. They all have tejas. There's not raga dvesha. They all have that antakarana shuddhi. And so if we take the word div, which means to illuminate, to shine, to be full of tejas, that, when it becomes a noun, that E of div takes guna and becomes dev. So deva is a nominal form of div. And then if you go from div to deva to daivi, daivi, just a little for a little Sanskrit people. So you've got the E which becomes A which becomes I. I is a vriddhi letter. So div becomes deva becomes daivi. That daivi means the one, that which, like the wealth which has that, the wealth which has that luminosity, you know, which is daivi, which has that for its core quality, right? So it, that wealth is full of that luminosity or that tejas, you know, or that's where we say that kind of a sattvic. It's that mind which enjoys that sattva. So if a mind enjoys sattva, means that, you know, like a shiny mirror reflecting the sun. That mirror is very sattvic because it reflects the sun, as opposed to, if we say the mirror that's reflecting, it reflects the sun true to what the sun is. It's almost like the sun is abiding in that mirror. The mirror is so clean, right? But if the mirror were to become wavy, like say the sun is reflecting in a wavy ocean, clear but wavy. Right? That can be rajas. Rajas with sattva. There's agitation, there's the reflection is not so pure. And then say the water or the mirror is very dirty and dusty. It can be cleaned, but it's very dirty and dusty. And that type of mirror barely reflects the sun at all. That's tamas. That dirty, dusty mirror is like the asuric. What these qualities, the type of qualities that the asuras have, those type of minds don't reflect the sun well. They don't. The nature of your being is not resonant with the nature of the mind. Right? It illumines the nature of the mind, but the nature of the mind is very dark and agitated and angry and full of rage and sorrow and suffering. You know. So it's not that yourself isn't totally present to that mind in all of its purity. And you can differentiate it fully and completely in the midst of this hurting mind or in this angry mind or in this very selfish mind. You're still completely present, right? But what is being illumined is a lot of painful affect, right? That's the mind that is kind of clouded over with dust, right? A dusty mirror doesn't really reflect the sun very well. It's illumined by the sun. The sun's a great analogy. Just think of it. If you have the dusty mirror, right? The same sun that illumines the clear mirror and the wavy mirror is there. The sun isn't affected by the dusty mirror. It isn't dusty, right? It isn't covered in any way or affected in any way. But the mirror that's being illumined doesn't itself really enjoy from its own standpoint the very nature of the sun, right? It's not reflecting the nature of the sun. So here, of course, with an analogy, all analogies are different, but to understand here is that a mind that's like a dusty mirror, right, that mind is not something that is going to, from its own standpoint, have the capacity to recognize itself as being full of love, right? It can't, because it's full of dust. And the dust, the hurt, is very much non-resonant with your very being that's illumining it. And so you're identified with that mind, and you have no way, no discrimination, no ability to discriminate the mind, the qualities of the mind, from the sun, the self, yourself, that is in all of its divine purity, absolutely present there, you know. You're going to be drawn, of course, toward the pain in the mind. That's where you'll be drawn. It's just like if your body is hurting, if you've broken your leg. Everything about you runs to the attention of the pain in the leg. You know? That's the focus. So when your mind is hurting, everything is drawn to that pain. You know? And then you have whatever skills and whatever ways that you know to try to handle that pain. That's what you're all about at that time. And you're going to use what you know and the skills that you have to deal with it. Right? So if you have Vedanta and some of these psychology methods, you have a lot of ways to deal with it that are actually very, very useful. But it still remains a fact that you will be dealing with it. See what I mean? It could have wonderful, wonderful tools. And I think with Vedanta and with its knowledge and with psychological tools that we have. You have wonderful, wonderful tools. You can come in here, Tibby. Come on. Come on. You have wonderful tools to deal with it. Right? But this is the point. The point is, you're still dealing. Because you have to deal with it. You know? It's like, even in the world, if somebody is hurt, and somebody is crying, you know, somebody needs attention, that's where your focus will go. Is to there, to take care of that. So whether it's internal or external, that's where your focus goes. It goes toward the pain, you know. And so what if your mind, you know, the only way that you know to deal with your pain and with your needs is to keep fulfilling desires, you know. That's how you deal with it. that is more pain and more pain and more pain and more pain. Something has to unravel. You have to start unraveling to get to a mind that, first of all, realizes that this doesn't work out here. This continual fulfilling these desires, it doesn't work. It's a very fragile world. And one fulfillment of one desire doesn't take care of you. And the fulfillment of the next desire doesn't take care of you either. Nor the next, nor the next, nor the next. So you finally understand, and then you start moving inward toward Dharma. Because you just by experience, you start to realize that really Dharma takes care of you much better than the fulfillment of just desire, sensory gratification. Dharma is longer lasting. Dharma gives a deeper peace. You have more control over it. Much more control over Dharma than you do over sensory gratification. Dharma is more long-lasting. So Dharma starts taking priority after you've been through lifetimes of experience, however long it takes you. Dharma itself starts becoming more dominant. As Dharma becomes more dominant, your mind gains more shanti. The more shanti it gains, the more natural ananda is there. The more space you have, the more available your mind is to this knowledge, actually. Because the mind that's still totally focused out here just isn't available because they're focused out here. The ananda that I want is out here. There's a certain amount of maturity that has to take place before the mind is in any way available for this knowledge. The mind that becomes available for this knowledge has some of this daivi samput. You know, it has space. It has vairagya to a degree, or it's not available. The asuric mind, the ones that we're going to spend the 20 verses on, that mind is simply not available because the focus is still totally extrovert in terms of what I need to make me happy. That's why they just lay the whole thing out. Power, the need for power, the need for wealth, the need for different forms of gratification are what I believe I need to be happy. And it goes on and on and on and on, and you're kind of digging yourself into a deep, deep hole. So he goes through all of these. So here he starts. The first one he talks about as the value in the Daivi Sampat is Abhayam. Abhayam is the beautiful one to choose as the first one. The sannyasi vow, when a person takes sannyasa, that takes the orange, and they go through the various rituals, the most important vow that they take is the vow of abhayam. And abhayam, the vow is this. So we're talking here in turn of, we're not talking really about self-knowledge now, we're talking about within relativity, within the relative world. So this vow of abhayam, it's true for Vedanta also. All of these are true for Vedanta also, but they also have relative reality. Abhayam is, may I not be afraid of any being, and may no being be afraid of me. That's abhayam. And so when Swamiji talks about this in a really interesting way, he talks that what's the first fear would be fear of death. Fear of death. Second fear really is, main fear is fear of loss, losing something that's important to you. But what's more important to you than yourself? So if you think that you're going to die, the fear of death is maybe a fear that haunts people. So he talks about that in an interesting way. The fact is that all of us are going to die. There's really no exception. Not like somebody's not going to die. all beings are going to die. But, you know, we also don't need to focus on that. What we need to focus on, you accept that, that's true, but today you're alive. Right? It's really simple. Today you're alive. So live out this day. Be grateful for this day. And when it's time for you to die, you'll deal with it. Today is not that day, right? We all know that day will come. There's no getting around it. And just know that when that day comes, then you'll deal with it.
But you don't have to deal with that now. And so now deal with the day that's here. And be appreciative of the day that's here. And know that when that day comes, you'll deal with it. I think that's very practical.
Mm-hmm.
And anything else is... What else is there, honestly, when you start thinking about what else is there? We're always going to get sick and die. Okay? So, aren't we? Yeah, okay, that's the end of it. We're going to get sick and die. We're not there yet. So why be there now? Why not be there when Bhagavan gives you that day? When that day comes, then that's your day. Just like you have your birth, you have your death. And you're going to have your own particular death. So when that time comes, that's what you'll be doing. And that's just the practical reality of it. So right now, be with your life and live. You know, an interesting experience I had with this, not it wasn't about my own death, but when my parents, all of a sudden, it's 5 or 6 years ago, I guess now, my mother had a serious stroke and was put in the hospital. And my father at that time totally lost his... They had a little bit of Alzheimer's, but he totally went under within like 24 hours.
Mm.
And so they were... We had a year before that time of where they needed a lot of care. And then we had the 4 months when then my mother died within 7 days of her stroke, and then my father died exactly 4 months later, which honestly they say that in married people who've been married for a long time, 4 months...
Mm-hmm.
And he was right at 4 months, and he died. But I noticed this with myself, with my siblings, and with friends who have gone through the death of their parents, or something where all of a sudden life changes, and it's time for you to take care of your parents. Right? That time has come. And for us, in all of my siblings and myself, when that time came, then that's what we all did. And before that time came, we were doing other things.
Yeah.
But when that time, I think, said Mathal, I think you had experience like that too, when the time comes, that's what you do. And you don't do anything else. That's there for you to do. You know? And it's natural. And I think, you know, when you get ill, when you're going to die, I mean, that's what you do. That's your life at that time. And it's a natural thing. It's part of your prarabdha. And so I realized that when I was driving from here every day to, where was it, near Napa? It was about an hour from here. To see my dad when he was in the hospital and all that, and my parents, and we were kind of camping out at the hospital and all that. That's what we did. And nobody thought, you don't think anything. Why do I have to do this, or why do I have to do that? You don't think anything. You just do what you're, because that's the world, that's your world at that time. And I think life is like that. Now this is our world at this time. Tomorrow will be different. Tomorrow will be different, but we will be there. We'll be there when that happens. Whatever the day is, that's our day. Just like today is our day. Tomorrow is our day. The next day is our day. And one day it'll be our last day. And that'll be our day too. it's just so Swamiji sometimes is so simple. It's so beautiful. You have to contemplate on the simplicity because it kind of solves the problem. You know, so, and he says, you know, what he was saying around all of this, what you have to do is when you have these fears or even worry about fear of loss, fear of death or fear of loss or loss of your money, loss of your power, loss of your respect, all of the things that people feel they need to have a happy life, the loss of all of these things, you know, is to just give them up mentally.
Mm-hmm.
And see if you give them up mentally, what would that be like? You know, what would you do? What would that be like? You'll still be there. You will still be there. That's a really interesting thing. We realize this. You might not realize it consciously, but you know what? In your whole life, things are coming and going and coming and going, but the truth is that as they come and go, you're still there. And what's really interesting, especially as you gain knowledge, you are still there, and everything that you need for your wholeness is still there. Because the wholeness
that you require to be a whole person is your own being. Your own problem is you're projected out. There's some ajnanam involved. But in reality, the wholeness that you need to be a whole person is the very swarupa of yourself. And so what's interesting is even if you have total ajnanam, you don't know that at all. You have no idea. Since that's the reality, when your mind goes over the shock, gets over the shock of these losses, or gets over the shock of your reaction, you know, and so the muddy water clears up, the wholeness reemerges. When your mind clears up, because you can only hold an upset for so long, you know, you can only hate for so long, you can only be angry for so long, you can only blame others for so long, you know, you can only think you need something for so long. And then it wears itself out. And when it wears itself out, there you are. The same whole person that doesn't have anything wrong at all. And that's always kind of a surprise. You know? But it's the truth. You don't have knowledge until you have... You don't have knowledge, so you don't know that's the truth. You don't know that you've been there all along. But you still... You continually resurface. You continually resurface. In fact, you're not resurfacing. That's not really what's happening. What's happening is the mind can't hold its tension that long. It can only hold its tension and its anger for a certain amount of time, or its distress for a certain amount of time, and then it has to let go. And when it lets go, you're back. But you've never been away. You've never been gone. But it seems like you're back and everything's okay. Everything has always been okay. The difference between a jnani and an ajnani, really, is that the jnani knows about this, the constancy of your okayness. The mind of the jnani knows of the constancy of your okayness. And so it just has to dip right back. It just dip. If it gets a little screwed up in terms of your reactions or this or that, it just dives right back into your own being. But an ajnani doesn't know that at all. So the ajnani gets that type of shanti through dharma, really, where the dharma becomes more important than the raga dvesha. Then it gains a mind that's more like a clear water bucket or a clear mirror. And so it enjoys a more peaceful life of well-being because the mind is more peaceful. For the mind that has a lot of raga dvesha, and a lot of complexes, a lot of things coming out. It's a very rough ride, but that rough ride also has moments of shanti. And then you're back. Then rough ride, moments of shanti, you're back. It's kind of like the drowning person in the river, or they use the example of the drowning person in the ocean. You know? They're up, the tides push them up, and everything's fine, here they are. They can breathe, everything's wonderful. The tide pulls them down, pushes them up. Pulls them down, pushes them up, pulls them down. At some point, you know, you're back, thank God. But comes a time when you just don't want to be pulled down. Mm-hmm. You don't want a temporary upness. You don't want to be temporarily up. You know? Nobody wants to be temporarily up. You never want to be temporarily yourself, you know, to lose it. Nobody wants that. So Dharma gives you a certain... Dharma, or just learning the values, relative values of being loving, of being honest, of being giving, of all of these qualities that we're going to go through, gives you the relative shanti where you're close, your mind is close to yourself. Mm-hmm. Like it's clear, it's close to yourself. And so you don't have this wild ride. We have to learn how to be with the parts that give us the wild ride in such a way that they can be released. So the mind enjoys a relative shanti. So one of them is this working on your fear, just in a relative way. Just, you know, with knowledge, knowledge takes care of a lot of the problems, but just relatively also, if you're afraid of something, to then bring your logic to it. Even the fear of death, even the fear of loss, as though when that loss comes, then that'll be your day and you'll deal with it. Deal with what's right in front of you. If you deal with what's right in front of you, there's not much fear. Because what is in front of you, you can handle. if you just watch your reactions, a lot of the things that cause so much pain are projections into what's going to happen in the future. If you're just dealing with what's happening now, you're usually fine. So that's what a lot of the Abhayam. Next one he says is this, that Bhagavan says is this, Sattva Samshuddhihi. This is really the Sattva Samshuddhihi, is really that Antakarana, the Antakarana Shuddhi, is that purity of mind. Just relatively, that purity of mind involves some relative vairagya. That relative vairagya means what causes the impurity of mind, if we don't go all the way to knowledge, what really causes it is raga dvesha. So I need this to be happy. It's the desire template. I must have this to be happy. I must not have this to be happy. Right? I have to have this to be happy. I have to get rid of this to be happy. The problem is with that whole thing is that you're ananda. When your ananda is totally tied to the sensory manipulation of the world, I need this to be happy. You can say, it was so nice, this is more of a jnani. I need this. We need things. Mm-hmm. I need this. I want this. This a mahatma. I need this. I want this. And if you don't get it, that's fine too. Mm-hmm. That's the freedom. It's not that you have to need and want things all that, you know, that you're not supposed to have any needs or any wants or any desires. The desire, but you don't want the full desire template. Enjoying your ananda, I would like to do this. Enjoying your ananda, I would like to study this. I would like to do this. I would like to do this. If I can't do it, that's fine. That vairagya. The way that you really have that vairagya again within relative world, and more, this is a practice. It's considered one of the major sadhanas. For jnani, it's the desire template has been broken. I want this, but I don't need it to be happy. For the whole kind of Vedic culture, as one matures and one becomes more of a mumukshu, the attitude more is, what I do, you tend to work toward this just gradually or naturally. I do what is there to be done. I do what is here to be done. What is my dharma? That is what I do. That's what I'm interested in. Things that are pleasurable that come my way, that's fine. You know? But my focus is on doing my dharma, doing my duty. That's more of a mumukshu. And so I gain that, I grow into that as I become a mumukshu. Because I've already gained a certain vairagya. One of the things that makes you into a mumukshu is that you've started gaining a vairagya toward the fulfillment of desires. Because the fulfillment of desires is a real hassle. It is. When the desire takes over, then a lot of emotion kicks in, you know. And there comes a time when you don't want to give desires that much power. You start to enjoy more and more being current, being present to what actually is and doing what's being asked of you in the situation. And that actually gives more ananda. It gives a deeper ananda. Desires give a lot. It's like when you're caught up into the desires, I need this and I need that, then the waters get rough. And when you're present to what is, look at any situation that you're in. This is your situation and it's full of all kinds of things. It's packed every day. Every moment is packed. Even if you're taking a walk in nature, you are totally 100% surrounded by that situation. So every moment you are surrounded by your situation with plenty to do.
just being in the situation. Mm. And the situation is here. So this moment is your situation. So in this situation, be dharmic. So what does it mean to be dharmic? You know? The golden rule. All of different, if you just want to say overarching, what is it to be a dharma, to be dharmic? Ahimsa. Behave in a way that doesn't hurt anybody. Swamiji says, and he talks about this, that's the overarching is ahimsa. Behave in a way that doesn't hurt anybody. And you know what he says? That includes animals. And that even includes trees. Be in a way that doesn't hurt any living being. That's the dharma overarching. So then we go down the golden rule. Okay, what does that mean? To not hurt any living beings? How can we say it differently? Well, behave in a way toward others as you would really want them to behave toward you. That requires a lot of consciousness. You know, everybody knows the golden rule. I was taught the golden rule when I was about 3 or 4 years old. You know, that's what you learn in Sunday school. Everybody knows the golden rule. And in India, it's, you know, treat others in the way that you would want to be treated. And don't treat them in a way that you wouldn't want to be treated. You know? And Swamiji will always say, that's true for all living. That's true for all living creatures, for all living beings, for all animals, and for all plants, and all trees, to have that consciousness. I mean, say we all held that consciousness, and say that was our dharma, that was what we were devoted to, is that. Not these raga dveshas. Raga dveshas, these likes and dislikes, are so, it's kind of superficial, really. Mm-hmm. But just think, if the whole focus is on that, to not harm any living creature, you know, that's totally different. So that's really that karma yoga buddhi. Because then everything is really in honor of Ishvara. It's beautiful. If it's worthy of contemplation. Right? So that sattva shuddhi really comes about through that practice of dharma. And practice of dharma, if you start with ahimsa, then go down to the golden rule, and then you go down to all of the particular dharmas that you find in your particular life, in your particular situation. You know, we all have duties. Swamiji always say, instead of rights, think of duties. Like, it's my right that you treat me in this way. You know, that's my right for you to treat me in this way. Well, how about if you say like this, as it would heal it, you say like this, like, it's my duty to treat you in this way. Let everybody have duties, not rights. And then everything's much nicer. It's a much nicer life. It's my duty to care for you. It's my duty to take on this responsibility. It's my duty to do this. Instead of, it's my right that you do these things for me. But all of these things create a different type of mind, right? And then the jnana yoga, givastitihi. This jnana yoga means here, the yoga here is the contemplation on your knowledge from mumukshu. Having your life, keeping your mind, keeping this knowledge in your mind, the jnana. And that jnana yoga, here the yoga is the really keeping through contemplation, you know, we gain this knowledge. If you come to class and you gain this knowledge and you walk out the door and it goes away. I mean, that's how it used to be for me. Right? I'd be listening, be in class, it would all be so clear, it would be so wonderful, and see everything, and I would feel just cleansed totally. And I would walk out of the Yajnashala, where this is in India at the course, I would walk out, and I'd be 3 or 4 steps out, and everything would just collapse. You know, I've told the story before, but I remember saying one time to myself, you know, someday I'll make it all the way up to my room. We had to walk up this hill, you know, to the room.
And this knowledge will still be there, and it won't have been overwhelmed by this and that and the other thing. And that day actually did happen, and I and when it happened, I recognized that I remember having the thought, I made it all the way to my room. I can make it. That's a beautiful thing, you know, because your mind can hold. Your mind has understood for long enough. You've understood for long enough. You've done enough shravana that the mind now really holds. It on its own holds this knowledge. It's a beautiful thing, but it takes some time. And we all takes different time for everybody. But it takes some time for the mind to totally be able to hold that knowledge. And so that's why we have nididhyasana. Nididhyasana is contemplation, so that what even the class itself is a meditation. It is a contemplation. Your mind is taken into that space. You're living in that space during the class. You're living in that space during a guided meditation. Then you have to know how to take your mind back into the space when you leave the class, and then it gets pulled out. Until it doesn't. Until it never gets pulled out. But if it does get pulled out, you need to have a value for bringing it home and doing that contemplation and remembering what is real, you know. Just coming back to yourself, always coming back to yourself. And when your mind is behaving like an asura, you know, with all of the values that cause pain, you have to realize that. And you have to know how to bring the mind back home. Because it's just running amok based upon, you know, its past experiences. And it needs to be brought up. You need to raise it, you know. It's like training your puppy. Little puppy is kind of hard to train. There's nothing like a trained puppy. Yeah, very beautiful, you know. But at first, they don't train that well. I think little children also. They need some structure, and they need some love. Yeah? They need loving structure. Your mind needs loving structure, especially in the areas where it's behaving in a way that causes it pain. So this jnana yoga vyavastitaha means that abiding in that meditative space, learning how and having a value for bringing your mind back to this knowledge. Okay, that's half a line, not bad. For the next half, about next time. No, we can do, from this point on, it's faster. It's
Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti 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 Harihi. Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi. Om.
You know, the values in chapter 13, that Swamiji spoke, value of values, it starts with a hymn, you know, Amani Troma Dambi Troma Himsa Kshanti Adajavam, 3 or 4. The sannyasis and the brahmacharis will chant that every day and contemplate on each one of those values. I was thinking this whole chapter, you know, is interesting to really study each value so that you actually have a value for the value. Even the negative ones, because if you contemplate on the negative ones, you contemplate on the something that you don't want, a way that you don't want to be. And so when these ways that you, then these ways, and they're very crystallized, when they come up in your mind, you recognize them as something, oh, this is that, and this is not what I want. You know, this is not what I value. And you've worked, you've thought about it. You've actually thought about it. And so then when that type of behavior arises in your mind, you recognize it. It's almost like an auto-suggestion because you've thought about it before. And so then when it rises in the mind, you recognize it and you know what to do with it. You know, otherwise it just becomes habitual behavior instead of conscious relationship with ways of behaving that aren't really in our best interests at all.
But you know this fear of loss, some losses can be absolutely devastating. So how does that fear of loss apply to that kind of loss?
Well, the problem, well, I think one of the major problems with fear, like fear of death or fear of loss, is that we start suffering the fear, we start suffering the loss before it's ever happened. In other words, it's an imagination. It's a worry about something that's going to happen. It's called anticipatory anxiety.
Yeah.
And so that anticipatory anxiety, it's actually often worse. It's worse than
the loss
itself. Because when the loss happens, you're there to deal with it. You take care of it. You do what you need to do because this thing has happened. And it's current. It's in the present. But what happens is that we spend so much time imagining something happening and then really suffering over that. We waste a lot of time in this imaginary suffering, a world of imaginary suffering. And so if you have a fear now about something that you're afraid is going to happen,
mm-hmm.
you have to kind of learn how to find that strength in yourself to say, when that happens, I'll deal with it. If that happens, I'll deal with it. Right now, it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's something right now in the present that I can effectively do to counteract that from happening, then that's something I can do. But that's not usually what's going on. What's usually going on is that I'm living in an imaginary world, painful world, that I've created for myself out of fear.
And how does that help to live in that imaginary world?
It doesn't help. That's what I'm saying.
But then it's so it's a common pattern of mind.
Yeah, and a lot of people live their whole life there. And so that's why I'm saying it's so helpful to consciously recognize it so that then you can pull your mind back. Otherwise, you know, we're either living in the past worrying about what has happened, or we're living in the future worrying about what's going to happen. You know, and nobody's right here in the present. If you're in the present, usually when you're in the present, you're fine. Because it's here and you're dealing with it. Yeah, you're just dealing with it. There's no problem. But we're not usually living in the present. You know? And so maybe when your mind is out in this imaginal zone of fear and worry, you can learn to say something to your mind like, this isn't happening now. I don't have to worry about this now. When it happens, I'll deal with it. And you know, what's another interesting thing is in the present, when you're actually dealing with what is right in front of you, there isn't any worry or anything. You're just dealing with it. This is what you have to do in this situation. So I think it's really helpful to just notice these things, to take note. Because if you don't take note of it, then
you're stuck.
You're just going on and on and on in this habitual living in a world that's not here, in a created world, you know, that doesn't have any reality, but that's the reality you're living in. It's very common. I mean, everybody talks about it.
Well, did you have to tackle that kind of pattern?
With my own level of worries, we all do. You give all of that up the more you kind of recognize your own wholeness. That's all part of
growth. We're all growing. And you know, this knowledge, as you gain this knowledge, everything changes inside in light of this knowledge. That's just how it is. In fact, you can even say, in light of any knowledge, any maturation, then now, when you, not even in reference to this knowledge, just as you mature psychologically, say, then the way you treat the world, the way you treat yourself, changes in the light of the way you are now. Right? And the way you are next year, then you are responding differently to the world based upon how you are. So with this understanding, with self-knowledge, the way you treat your own mind, the way you treat the world, your expectations, your needs are all different. They're very different. Because what if I don't no longer need the world to be a source of ananda for me? It never has been anywhere. That's all been illusory. So, but what about once I finally figure that out, and I also know the source of it, then my relationship with the world becomes much simpler, because then I can just be present to the world as it is. So if the world really and truly is not a source of ananda, that the source of ananda is your own being, that's where the ananda resides. It doesn't reside out here, you know. So once you know that, then you can be with everything out here as it is. Because one thing isn't more of a source of ananda than another. The source of ananda is yourself. But that requires kind of a reeling in of all of these projections that you've had lifetimes of making. So that's why we say there's emotional lag time. It's not like you gain knowledge, you see it clearly, and then all of this emotional structure all just goes up in smoke. It doesn't. The whole emotional structure, all of your likes and dislikes, the whole person that you are now comes into, it rises up into a buddhi, into your mind that has a different understanding. And then that person that you are now with that different understanding helps all of this emotional baggage, this old way of being, you know, it metabolizes, or it takes care of that old way of being by bringing in a new way of being, new knowledge. But it will still keep rising up, you know, until it's been assimilated. Until those ways of behavior have assimilated this knowledge, have been exposed to this knowledge. So your buddhi has this knowledge, then old ways of behavior, old habits come up and expose themselves to you, to your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know how to take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But before, when they would come up, you didn't have that knowledge in order to deal with it in a different way. And so they just keeps coming up.
So the buddhi could be not of time, but the body-mind complex could be of time.
Well, the buddhi is really the intellect, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we mean by the buddhi. So the buddhi is the one, the mind, but that deeper mind, the mind that's capable of gaining knowledge, clarity, that one gains knowledge. Right? Like you gain even relative knowledge, it's the buddhi that gains knowledge. And so now that buddhi is going to be with with your knowledge, are going to be presented with a lot of previous ways of reacting, emotional reactions, ways of being, that really are not really who you are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or what you're, that doesn't even go along with your value system. But now you have to give that, you have to be able to assimilate that those old ways of action, behavior have to rise up in the new you who deals with them differently.
Mm-hmm.
Or could you say rise up in awareness?
Yeah, but if they're always rising up in awareness, awareness of human consciousness. But now the buddhi has a different understanding. It's rising up into a different understanding.
So it's kind of like they're just rising up to be murdered.
Yeah.
or die, I mean.
Yeah, they're rising up to die.
They're final rising up.
Yeah.
And then they're just...
They might rise up one or two, three times.
X number of times, but yeah. they're closing out.
Yeah. They're closing out, yeah. Definitely closing
that's
out.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's freedom.
It's freedom. And you have to be patient. Let them work themselves out. It's like being a good parent. Because they are on their way out. There's no way.
And so nobody's innocent from this process.
No. No one.
But you know, one thing when we talk about virtue, there's always this issue that comes up for me, which is that it makes sense in light of jnanam.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And without jnanam,
it doesn't get total resolution.
It seems like it's always a frustrating. You're always going to fall short. I mean, even with jnanam, you have. It's not easy.
No, yeah, you always will fall short because there's no such thing as perfection, even for a very dharmic, saintly person.
Yes.
You know, it still has to be maintained.
Right, but with
jnanam, there's no perfection, there's no possibility of perfect maintenance. Whereas for a jnani, you know, you can't. It's impossible. It's a relative world. Right. But for a jnani, the self is timeless.
Right.
The self is not going to change no matter what you do. So from the standpoint of the self, there is no problem at all. There's no time.
And there's no absolute expectation either.
Well, for the self is the self. It's not judging you or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's where the moksha is, in the recognition that yourself is whole and complete and good. It's ananda, it's wholeness, it's fullness, it's love, it's whatever words you want to use to point to it. And there's nothing you can do about it. You can't make it better, you can't make it worse, you can't get rid of it, you can't have the mind will never be away from it. You know, it's free, totally free. And your mind is a funny mind. So I'm telling you, this was a great liberation for me when Swamiji, who to me is the greatest embodiment of this knowledge, and I've known him since I was 22, and he has not disappointed. But in terms of, but this was, he said, "Oh, the mind, my mind, it does all kinds of funny things. So what? Mm. You know, because you think, oh, you're going to have knowledge, and now the only thoughts you will have, you're walking around all the angelic thoughts." It's not true. It isn't true. That there's billions of thoughts of data coming in from the universe. And stuff's coming out too, all kinds of stuff. But that doesn't mean you're reacting to it or engaging in it or, you know. That's that shama and dhamma, these thoughts are passing through. How are you to, are you supposed to decide which thoughts are passing through before they pass through?
What?
Yeah, so you can dodge them. The thoughts rise and there they are. You didn't tell them to rise. You know, they rise, there they are. They are what they are. You don't have to engage with them. You can be with them in whatever way you want, but to say that you can't have this thought or have that thought, that's not going to work.
Well, who's responsible for these thoughts? You make it sound like it's just the mind in operation rather than
it's just the mind
responsible.
The responsibility comes with how do you engage with the thought.
Yeah.
Like, that's true. I was talking about this, I forget which class, last week. There's nothing really much you can do about which thoughts are rising and passing through. There's a huge reservoir of unconscious. Like Jung gives an example of the unconscious like this. If you imagine, here's the ocean. Okay, here's the wavy ocean. And imagine an iceberg in the form of a triangle. So here's the wavy ocean, and here's the triangle. Okay, this little tiny tip bobbing up above the ocean is the conscious mind. And this is the unconscious. It's a very, very vast.
And so here's the world with all through our sense organs just flooding in. The defense system, we have filters that kind of filter what we can actually assimilate at any given time. The rest is pouring into the unconscious. And then our filters give us what we need to know. Testing. Oops.
Oh, wait a minute. I just lost everything.
Yeah, that's because so did they.
Okay.
But not only lost everything, everybody's gone. Gosh. Testing. Can you hear? Anybody still there?
I'm here.
No, you're not.
So, anyway, it's not the problem. You can't say much about the thoughts that are passing through.
Mm-hmm.
You know? The more you've kind of neutralized your raga dveshas, the less type of upset thoughts you'll have. But the problem for you is not the thoughts. You're going to have vairagya toward the thoughts.
Because that's contrary to what we've been taught, that you are responsible for what you think. I mean, I caused that
but
thought.
That isn't true.
Okay.
What is true is how you deal with the thought. What do you do? Like, say you have a thought of hatred passes through. But are you going to blame yourself because you had a thought of hatred passing through? It's only when you take the thought and make a volitional thought, you know, like where you curse somebody volitionally. That's a karma. But that you have a terrible thought passing through, it's not a karma. It's something passing through. You wouldn't choose to have it passing through. It's passing through. There's all kinds of things that can be passing through.
So the mind is almost kind of like the outside world. You just can't control it. It's just happening.
Yeah,
just
in a sense. Yeah. The type of quality of thoughts do change as the raga dveshas as these likes and dislikes get neutralized. You know?
So you can say it's the unconscious, just playing.
Unconscious material, yeah. Unconscious material coming up. All kinds of funny things can be coming up.
Mm-hmm.
For you, the mind has. For a person who has knowledge, the mind has much more shanti. You know, because the raga dveshas that generate a lot of distress when they're not being fulfilled. You know, that's not there. that level is not there. Right? Because you're not asking them to be fulfilled. You don't care. Because the wholeness of yourself is better. And in fact, you don't really want the raga dveshas because they create agitation. So who cares? If you tend to give up the raga dvesha as soon as they rise, your attachment to them, because the anand, the wholeness of yourself, is better. Okay? But say whatever thought, so there's that. On another level, whatever is passing through is passing through. You know, you don't judge yourself because of what is passing through your mind. What do you do with it? Like, say some horrible thought passes through your mind and then you think, okay, man, I am going to kill that guy. Say some hateful thought passes through and then you think, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Okay. Okay, then you're in trouble. Yeah. But the funny thought just going through it, that's, let it go, you know. Swami uses this example, I like it. Like, he uses the example of, say, you're taking a beautiful drive through the country, beautiful country, and the meadows and flowers and beautiful, and you're driving along, it's just enjoying the scenery. And then you turn around go around the corner, and here is this huge garbage dump. And it smells and it is totally ugly, you know. And what do? You just go, ooh. But you don't become the garbage dump. You experience the garbage dump. And then you keep driving through it, and then you get back into the beautiful scenery, and then you don't become the beautiful scenery either. You don't become either one of them. You know? There's no problem. You don't care for the garbage dump. You like and prefer the beautiful. But you haven't become it. So like that with your mind. If the thoughts are garbage dump thoughts are passing through, they're passing through. You prefer them that they get it, but perhaps. if you even bother. But why even bother? Mm. Why even comment on it? It's the mind. Why even engage in it? You don't need to. But we tend to have all of these values and judgments. Oh, I shouldn't have that thought, or why am I thinking like this? And Swamiji would say, who cares? The mind has all kinds of funny thoughts. What difference does it make?
Well, Jung with this iceberg, with mm-hmm. the little tip, he would be saying the same thing then. What causes the thought is not necessarily the little tip at the top. Who knows where it's coming from?
Often it is who knows what it's coming from. Who knows where it's coming from? There's a whole another layer that of problems that we suffer from. The mind suffers from because of ajnanam, because of self-ignorance, which generates all these likes and dislikes. And likes and dislikes are real for the until they're not. By real, I mean this template. I need this to be happy. I want this so that I can be happy. That's a desire. That's the whole thing. If I want this, but I'm fine without it, then it's no problem. Yeah, I want this, I like that, this is sweet, I'd rather have that not happen, but if it does, it's fine, I'll deal with it, it's not a big deal. Because I've pulled back the projection
yeah.
of the wholeness of myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And now this is another thing. Your fame and fortune and all of these type of things that you think that you need, actually you don't need those things. You don't
update. You, thank you.
You don't need for your sense of wholeness or sense of being loved, all of these things that are so important, to be whole, to be loved, all of that. That is the nature of the self. You get that from the self. You think that you're getting it from something out here, but all you're getting from out here is this illusory fulfillment of a desire that gives some shanti in the mind. It relaxes the mind for a moment. And so it's just like a clean mirror. You know, you get your mirror cleaned for the moment. And oh, then everything's fine. It's only fine because it's not disturbing from its own standpoint your own swarupa, your own nature, the sun. But from the standpoint of the sun, it does not require the mirror at all. It doesn't require the mirror to be clean. It doesn't require the mirror to be dirty or the mirror to be agitated. It doesn't require the mirror. My being does not require the mirror. I don't require my mind or the universe for me to be whole. That's the nature of the self. That's the freedom. And if you have that, if you've recognized that, your own wholeness, then this thought's passing through or this thought's passing through. It's a funny thought. It's not something I want to engage with. It just is what it is, but I don't become a good or bad person because of the thought.
So there's really that much separation then?
There's that much separation. In terms of yourself, yourself is free of all thoughts. I mean, the sun doesn't become a better person because the mirror is clean. You know, the sun just remains as the sun. Now the mirror might feel better being clean. You know, that's true.
But what do you mean by universe as still as an object, right?
What do you mean?
To make you happy.
I'm saying that the ananda or the wholeness or the being lovedness does not belong to the universe. The universe is mithya. That the wholeness or being loved is the nature of the self. When you say being loved, when we use that passive term, being loved, then in your mind you think, oh, I'm being loved because someone is loving me. So
yeah.
I love to be loved.
Yeah.
I love to be loved. But that being loved is the nature of consciousness itself. It is a completed state. So we think whenever I feel, I'm loved, my mind has become quiet. And so the am-lovedness is shining in the mind as though, and then I feel, you love me. Because of you, I am loved. That's the illusion. You are loving me, and so I feel loved.
what I mean by my understanding of the universe is like an expanded state.
I'm saying if you got rid of the whole universe, nothing would happen to you.
Yeah, but an expanded state is supposed to not make you so small. So there's a sense of happiness in that, of not feeling limited. But
yeah,
we're
but
talking
that,
straight objectivity.
Yeah.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah, if I have that expanded state in my mind, that's
mm-hmm.
a mental state.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I just appreciate Ishwar, I appreciate the world as it is.
Yeah.
Then there's no conflict at all.
Yeah.
Then my mind is relaxed, totally relaxed. And I'm just appreciating Ishwara. That jivatvam hasn't come. The jiva comes in, that sense of limitation, when I want something. There are times when I don't want anything. Then I can just appreciate Ishwara, you know. It's all fine because I'm not wanting anything. When I want something, then everything gets divided up, you know, into what will help me get that and who's going to take it away from me and will Bhagawan bless me? Does Bhagawan love me? Does Bhagawan really love me? Does Bhagawan think I'm worth anything? You know, to show me that he loves me by letting these things happen.
Yeah.
You know?
I want to be special.
Yeah. Then when something good happens to you, and your Bhagawan really loves me now. I'm just showing you how complicated it can get. Yeah.
It's kind of like this core movement of from the subject to the object in a way. You know? It's like kind of it's an object fixation. That the mind kind of...
It is an object fixation because I give myself to the object. I projected myself onto the object and then I need it. I need to get it back. It's like getting myself back. Oh, anyway, we're going to have a whole... it's fun to talk about these values. It's important and sometimes it's tedious also. But it's a good thing. In fact, you can... I would really... recommend reading Swamiji's. I don't know if you do read these things, the Gita Hum Siddhi, that, you know, I really would read it. It's really, because he really deals with it in a beautiful way. It's very insightful. And then these things become real. It really helps your mind.
Well,
to understand all these, especially the negative ones, because then they become things that are your sadhana. Otherwise, you're kind of unconscious about a lot of them.
Will all these values have to be taught in the light of
Vedanta?
Yeah, so
yeah.
We'll always be going back to that.
Yeah, we will.
That's the way we like it, huh?
Yeah. Well, there's nothing better to do.
Nothing better to do? That's true, actually. That's true for me.
For me, too.